Hey guys, thanks for joining us for this 143rd episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests on this episode include podcaster Dana Schwartz. We'll talk about her new podcast, Haleywood. We'll also visit with actor Greg Sulkin about the new Netflix series, Pretty Smart. We'll also visit with our pickmaster, Brandon Lang. We'll talk about this week's NFL and NCAA games. We'll also talk with host and author Tamryn Hall about her new novel, As the Wicked Watch. And we'll visit with singer and songwriter Townsend. She's got a new single, Stay, that's available now. Of course, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, comment, leave some feedback, check out the shop, and of course, share with your friends. Now here's a spooky question. Would you be willing to live with a ghost? Now what if it were a friendly ghost, you know, like Casper? Well, a new survey of more than 2,500 people, 30% said they would be willing to live with a ghost if he was friendly. Now 20% of people would live in a home where a murder had taken place after it's been thoroughly cleaned up, presumably. 17% would live in a haunted house, and that jumps to 46% if they get a discounted price. And 30% of people say they'd have no problem living next to a cemetery. 25% said they live next door to a haunted house. I think it's been just over 2 years when we spoke about one of her other podcasts. We've got Dana Schwartz on with us talking about a new one, Haleywood. And this one really intrigued me, Dana, and I'm sure you get that all the time, don't you?
I mean, I'm excited. Anytime that anything I make intrigues people, that's a good sign.
I know, right? Now, The Noble Blood was about true nobles. This is kind of about Hollywood nobles. And I'm kind of transposing your own words you said a few moments ago. Tell our listeners the Bruce and Demi story. This is one that I never knew of.
It's also one that I didn't know of until I started working on this podcast with the amazing Haleywood team. It's a story about a small town in Idaho in the mid-90s, and Bruce Willis at the height of his movie star powers, just married Demi Moore. They're this amazing power couple. He's filming a Die Hard sequel. They want to go somewhere to escape the Hollywood bubble. And so they buy this major property in Haley, Idaho, a small town that they stumbled upon. But then gradually, Bruce Willis starts to do something a little unusual. Not only do they live in this town, but Bruce Willis starts buying all the available property in the town, the, you know, local drugstore, vacant lots, extra homes in the town, a restaurant, an office complex, a bar. It's a really strange saga. I don't want to spoil anything else from there, but oh yeah.
What was your initial reaction when you started delving into the information yourself as you were familiarizing yourself with Haley, Idaho?
I mean, it sounds like a story out of a Bruce Willis movie, right? Like the stranger comes to town and starts buying up all the property. It sounds like it should be an action Western. I think it's just such an interesting story that encapsulates so much just beyond, the immediate. It's a story about bubbles that we create for ourselves, the Hollywood bubble, but also this idea of like the small town bubble and that ideal that we have for ourselves and whether it's actually real. And then it's also about, you know, power and money. And I think those are issues that are always relevant.
And how do you think the reaction of the townspeople, how do you think that changed over the time from when Bruce and them first came in until things got not so pretty, if you will?
Oh, that's a great question, because I think that Haley, Idaho is about 15 miles outside of the sort of ritzier Sun Valley area. And people like Clint Eastwood and Arnold Schwarzenegger also had properties nearby. So I think the locals in Haley were used to celebrities living in and around their town. And so when Bruce Willis first appeared, it was just sort of par for the course. And even when he started revitalizing the Main Street, I think there was a lot of positive goodwill towards him. I mean, he was investing a lot of money in their town and their community. But gradually over time, I think it became more apparent. And I don't want to project onto Bruce Willis, but that he was sort of rebuilding the town in his own image. He was sort of taking this small town and turning it into like Play-Doh for him to reshape into his little dream town. And I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
And Dana, what do you think the takeaway, the intended takeaway, I guess I should say, from the podcast, what is that intent for you?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because I think that different people will have different reactions. We try to paint a really even-handed picture of what happened. I mean, there's some who obviously still hold grudges against Bruce and what he did and continues to do to some degree. And there's some who are grateful that he revitalized their town. But I think that the main takeaway is to re-examine our relationship with celebrity culture and to re-examine the power that we give to celebrities and ask, in what context is that okay? And maybe in what context should we think about it a little harder?
And how much do you think that the changes that were going on during Bruce's time was related to maybe psychological issues that he was facing in just his day-to-day life? I'm not saying he was going psycho. That's not what I'm just saying. Psychological, mental issues because of the things he's facing in his regular day-to-day life, if you will.
I mean, I think you're hitting on exactly the reason he moved to Haley in the first place. Bruce Willis is famously a private person who dislikes and distrusts the press. And I think when he was sort of at the peak of his celebrity powers in the mid-90s, when he was marrying Demi Moore and they were sort of a tabloid fixture, he was trying to escape. He wanted to find a place that he could live where he wouldn't be Bruce Willis in all caps. But I think what happened in Haley was sort of this interesting thing where he wanted to be anonymous, but only on his terms. He also had, I think, still had something of a movie star ego.
That makes sense. That does make sense. And again, the new podcast, Haley Wood. Dana, I always want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can find more info, where they can get the new episodes, and then, of course, where they can follow you social media-wise as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you can get new episodes of Haley Wood every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe now. I have another podcast called Noble Blood, which is, as you mentioned, less about Hollywood royalty and more about actual royalty, which you can subscribe to. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Dana Schwartz with 3 Z's at the end.
That's good stuff. Well, Dana, it has been great to visit with you. Excited about the new podcast. I'm going to check out the episodes here real soon, and hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
So happy to talk again.
A jokey cryptocurrency called Shiba Inu tripled in value this past week, and some unknown person could have cashed in for an insane amount of money. It's a crypto no one really takes seriously because it's a parody of Dogecoin, but it's super cheap, so some see it as a chance to recreate the whole Doge explosion that happened this year. Now, one Shiba Inu coin is currently worth less than 1/10,000th of a cent, but that's a lot more than it was worth a few months ago. Last summer, it was worth even less, and someone just noticed a crypto wallet online that belongs to some nut job who bought a crazy amount of it last August. You can see the activity of any crypto wallet online, but there's no way to tell who it belongs to. Last August, they bought $8,000 worth of Shiba Inu, and in its peak week, it was worth about $6 billion, that's billion with a B. Now, whoever it belongs to didn't cash in, so people think they might have forgotten about it, lost their password, or died. Now, whatever the case may be, they haven't sold yet, and last time I checked, it was still worth over $4 billion. Got a new Netflix comedy, Pretty Smart, which premiered back on October 8th. You might remember him from the screen of a couple of shows before as well. We've got Greg Sulkin with us today. And first off, Greg, I appreciate you taking the time, brother.
Oh, don't be silly. Thanks for having me.
Now, Greg, tell our listeners, if you will, if they haven't seen the previews or the trailers about Pretty Smart, just the premise behind the show first off, if you would.
Yeah, so the show is a half-hour comedy. It's about a girl named Chelsea who lives in New York. and she moves to Los Angeles and is forced to live with her, some would say, less intelligent sister, and her eccentric group of friends. And so I play Grant, who's a personal trainer on the show. He plays one of the roommates and is basically going to get himself in a little love triangle between the two sisters, which is obviously a pretty unique dynamic, to say the least.
Now, for you, the character of Grant, I mean, how much of a stretch was it for you to work into the physical trainer? Did you have to do some extra body work, if you will?
Yeah, no, for sure. I definitely worked very hard. I definitely worked hard in the gym. They told me I was going to have my shirt off a lot. So I was like, you know what? Yeah, I better start making sure those greens are eaten. So, yeah, you know, I think overall, I worked very hard on the physical side of it. But the show itself is so much fun. I mean, it's probably the most fun I've ever had on the set. And I think you see that when you watch the show. It's so lighthearted. It's so fun. It's such an easy show to binge too, you know. And so overall, I've been so overwhelmed and just grateful for the show's response since it came out. So many people messaging me online saying, when season two? So the excitement for the show is definitely there. And just overall, I loved making it. So I'm excited for people who haven't checked it out yet to check it out.
And Greg, how much does it mean to you now in the times that we live in to have a show that is binge worthy? And I mean, I don't think that has been such an accredited word as we've had over the last 2 years, is it?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, look, obviously the last 2 years have been definitely tough for everyone in many different industries. I think the entertainment industry probably got hit harder than most, you know, because you literally couldn't be around people. So to have a show on Netflix that we're really proud of as a cast and as a team is very, very special. And yeah, it's also so incredibly special to share what you love with people and to give them enjoyment too. And so, you know, the response has been absolutely incredible, and I'm very grateful for that.
Greg, you talked about the time when everybody was shut down. What was the thing that kept you going? What was maybe the little thing that you kept tinkering with about your craft as well?
You know, I think everybody reacted differently, and I think that my mum always sort of taught me to never let the grass grow under my feet. So actually, during COVID, I created a clothing line and decided to sort of tap into my more entrepreneurial side, because I feel like I've always been a bit of an entrepreneur too, aside from being an actor. So yeah, I got to do things and got to do things I would have never done, you know, if that never happened, basically, because we did have some downtime. So it allowed me to go and read books, try and buy the rights to certain books, develop them into potential TV shows, which I'm currently doing. And so, you know, I definitely just wanted to keep focused. I didn't really want to, you know, I didn't want to take my mind off what I came to Los Angeles to do, which was, you know, be successful in this industry. So I definitely decided to keep my head down and focus. But yes, of course, it was hard because I'm a very social person too. So I think the hardest part for me was just not being able to hug other human beings. I think that was what was getting me down personally. But you know, everybody had their own individual struggles, and you know, it's been hard for most people, and I just respect everybody in our whole community for sort of sticking through it, because you know, it seems like we're coming out of it, and you know, everybody seems in better spirits, which is good.
And Greg, you've been on several series before. How much different was it trying to build a camaraderie coming into a new show with all of with everything that's been in place? Was that an extra challenge as well?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was an extra challenge, but it made us stronger, because you know, we really bonded as a cast. You know, we were sort of in our own bubble, so to speak, and we had to trust each other. We had to have each other's back. We knew that we weren't really going to see each other's faces until the day of shooting. We were rehearsing with masks on, which makes it, you know, a little bit tough. You know, it's tough to rehearse when you can't see somebody's face, but it is what it is. And you know, we had to put safety first. Thankfully, we didn't have one outbreak on set, and so our production went smooth. And that was down to, you know, everybody being safe and respecting each other's space, and yeah, working hard. And out of it came a very special bond between the cast, which you'll definitely see on screen when you watch the show. You know, it's I've loved cast members in the past. Some cast members in my career have become really close friends of mine. But I can't remember the last time on a set that every single person in the cast felt loved and felt like a family. I think this one was extremely special to me.
That's good. And again, Jen, talking about the new Netflix comedy, Pretty Smart, it is available now. And Greg, always want to make sure and let folks know where they can keep up with everything you've got going social media-wise as well, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just, my Instagram handle is my name, Greg Sulkin, GREGGSULKIN. And, you know, my mom was weird. I guess she gave me 2 G's at the end of Greg. I don't know why, but... Just Instagram and Twitter is where I'm at.
That's good stuff. Well, Greg, it has been a privilege to visit with you. Looking forward to keeping up with the show myself, and hope you have a great rest of your week, sir.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. You too.
Do want to say thanks to the sponsor for today's podcast episode, Smiley's Breezy Vapes, located at 313 Falcon Road. Stop in and see them for Wacky Wednesdays, plus they've got great specials and events going on Saturdays. Check out the largest selection of premium juices and disposable flavors in Southwest Oklahoma. That's Smiley's Breezy Vapes, 313 Falcon Road in Altus. For more information, you can call or text at 580-471-VAPE. That's 580-471-8273. I feel like I've spent a full year of my life watching TV just in the last 18 months. So this stat seems kind of low to me. A new study found the average person will spend 4 years and 2 months of their life streaming shows and movies. That's just counting the stuff that you stream. It doesn't include things that you watch on cable, if that's something you still do. Now, here are a few more digital activities and how much of our life is devoted to them. Number 1, live streaming sports, 3 years and 3 months. Number 2, playing video games, 3 years, 2 months. Number 3, online dating, 3 years and 1 month. Number 4, Zoom calls for work, 3 years. Number 5, listening to audiobooks and podcasts, 2 years and 9 months. Number 6, using social media, 2 years and 9 months. Number 7, streaming music, another 2 years and 9 months. And number 8, watching YouTube videos, 2 years and 5 months. Now, if you buy those numbers and add it up, it's over 23 years of your life spent on those 8 things alone, plus 4 more on shows and movies, so 27 years total. We're going to talk about the book, The First Shots, the epic rivalries and heroic science behind the race to the coronavirus vaccine. We've got award-winning journalist Brendan Burrell with us today. And first off, Brendan, I appreciate you taking some time to visit.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us the book yourself. I mean, obviously there was a race for the coronavirus vaccine and the backstory. I mean, what was it about it that really stuck out to you as something you just had to work on, if you will?
Well, like everybody else back in the beginning of last year, I thought I was going to be doing normal journalism, I guess, writing my stories, traveling around. And then I heard about this strange little virus out there in China. Suddenly my whole life was derailed. I'm hunkered down in my apartment. I can't tear myself away from the news. And I have a background writing about scary diseases. So naturally I had to put that to use. I mean, this was the kind of the story of the decade, maybe the century. So I decided to write a book about the vaccine race.
What is so intriguing about the race and about the competition that was going on to be the first to get it out there, if you will?
Well, what was intriguing for the companies was, of course, being first is bragging rights, and you get to take all that market share. As we've seen, Pfizer, the winner of the race, is has something like 2/3 of the market here in the U.S. and is just doing great all around the world. I think what I found was interesting in the early days was big companies didn't want to touch the vaccine. Mm-hmm. The problem with these emerging infectious diseases is they come and they go. And so you don't want to take all of your scientists who are working on things like seasonal flu vaccine and, you know, fancy drugs and all of that that makes the company regular profits and say, oh, go for Ebola, because probably it's not going to be a big market. And so many of these companies, Pfizer and Merck, they were just sitting on the sidelines in the beginning. And if you look at who won the vaccine race, yes, Pfizer eventually got, you know, threw its hat in. But it's all these smaller players like Moderna. And so this has been a real game changer. And that's kind of one of the fascinating parts of the story.
And about the speedy return or turnaround with a COVID virus vaccine, if you will. Brendan, how surprised were you by the timely turnaround and getting one that was not only put out there, but also approved by the FDA, multiples at that matter?
I don't think I'm alone in sort of raising my eyebrows when I heard about the announcement of Operation Warp Speed. You know, back then, as we know, Tony Fauci was saying, oh, you know, the fastest possible is going to be like 18 months. And I knew historically the fastest ever vaccine that had been released was the mumps vaccine. That took 4 years. I think many people sort of underestimated how fast the FDA could move and how fast companies could move if they had that financial cushion that came with Warp Speed and the incentive of seeing this market that's not going to go away.
And Brendan, also the hope to know that we can find some answers ourselves as well. I mean, for the medical community, I mean, how much of a pat on the back is this for them being able to do what seemed like the impossible?
Well, this demonstrated just how fast science can move. I mean, the medical community who were fighting COVID, these people are all incredible heroes. And I highlight, you know, some of the heroes in the book and in the scientific world. One of them is Barney Graham, this farm boy from Kansas, who ended up being a world-class virologist at the National Institutes of Health. And he's one of the figures that was instrumental in the early days of creating a prototype vaccine for the coronavirus, running these animal tests, and getting it into the first human trials as he collaborated with Moderna. So he's an amazing figure that I mentioned in the book.
And Brendan, what do you think this teaches us as we move forward? Say if another pandemic, please not happen, but if one were to come, about the preparation that we can have?
Well, going back to Barney Graham, one of his ideas is, so if we look at these, you know, coronaviruses are this thing that who knew it was going to blow up so big? Well, Barney kind of did. We have, if you break up all the viruses in the world, you can break them down to like 25 different families or groups of viruses that threaten people potentially. We have vaccines for about 12 of those. And what Graham argues is we should have scientists working on vaccines for all these other ones just in case they become a threat. And I think that would be a great investment.
That is cool. Now, again, the book, The First Shots, The Epic Rivalries and Heroic Science Behind the Race to the Coronavirus Vaccine. It rolls off the tongue, Brendan. Check out the book. And again, Brendan, thank you so much for your time this morning, sir.
Okay, appreciate it.
This story is so packed with crazy that I don't even have time to make a shake and bake joke. But a 25-year-old guy in Oregon named Alexis Gomez led cops on a high-speed chase this week and got arrested while wearing a Ricky Bobby costume from the movie Talladega Nights. He stole a truck around 6 p.m. on Tuesday and fired a gun at someone who started following him to get his license plate. That person also had a gun and returned fire, but no one got hit. Alexis eventually crashed into a random person's garage during a high-speed chase with police, but they still didn't catch him. He took off on foot. Then someone who lives nearby got an alert that the security system was going off. The homeowner's name is Paul Willie, and he was able to watch the rest of it unfold on a live security camera through his phone. Alexis broke into his house, and luckily no one in his family was home. Then he found the Ricky Bobby costume, put it on, threw some jewelry and other valuables in a suitcase, and tried to flee the scene on a bicycle with two flat tires. All of this while still wearing the full Ricky Bobby jumpsuit with matching hat.
Now, Paul had already called the cops, and an entire SWAT team had the house surrounded. So Alexis finally gave himself up. He's facing a long list of charges, including first-degree assault, attempting to elude police, and first-degree burglary. Police held on to the costume as evidence, but got it back to Paul in time for Halloween. It is time for our weekly visit with our good friend from BrandonLang.com, also the host of the Best Damn Sports Betting Pod, period. Warming his voice up in the background for us this morning. Brandon, good to visit with you, my friend.
Well, I got a case of bronchitis, and I'm at the tail end of it. So anybody knows if they've had bronchitis, the phlegm is the tail end of it. So we're trying to get through these radio shows today without hacking up half my lung. So life is good, brother.
Now, what did last night do for what you have the outlook for the weekend? A big win, and you kind of went against everybody, right?
Yeah, it's funny. It's I always say if you win that Thursday night game and can get a win Friday night, you take those two winning days into Saturday. It's just great momentum. I was able to do that. I think we're on a 5-1 run right now. And last night you looked at the game and you're like, okay, the line opened up 3.5. And then Devontae Adams wasn't playing, so it moved to 5.5. And then Lazar wasn't playing, so it moved to 6.5. I'm sitting there watching this line move going, okay, let me get this straight. You don't get Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Aaron Rodgers, elite quarterbacks plus 6.5 ever. And if you understand NFL rosters and you understand NFL players and you understand quarterbacks like Aaron Rodgers, if there's a receiver and he's on the field with Aaron Rodgers, he has gotten the Aaron Rodgers seal of approval that he can catch the football. Or he's not going to set foot on that field. Aaron Rodgers is thrown to every single receiver that's on the depth chart, that's on the roster, that's on the practice squad. You just don't get the reps. You just don't get, the targets, but you can obviously catch the football or you're not going to be on the field. And so the line value was created by the hype that they were banged up and no defensive coordinator, but every NFL staff's got 20 coaches. So everybody knows what they're doing. And so to get Aaron Rodgers plus 6.5, I'm like, you know what? The right side of the game, and I've always said on your show, there's a right side to a game and a wrong side to a game. And the right side of the game is if you're going to give me Aaron Rodgers plus 6.5, I'll take Aaron Rodgers and Sister Jean from Loyola, Chicago, and put her in the slot on the right with her yellow scarf and two Sister Jeans up on the left, and they'll get open because Aaron Rodgers is going to hit you. And that's exactly what happened. Their defense had enough stops, but at the end of the day, Aaron Rodgers in that running game just made enough plays and a critical mistake at the end by Arizona. And Kyler Murray with that fade route, that's a route that I absolutely hate when they run it down there in the goal line. And Rodgers, it's funny, Rodgers executed his fade route to Randall Cobb, and Kyler Murray didn't execute his fade route to A.J. Green, and that was the difference in the game. So there you go, Aaron Rodgers plus the points as a dog, always the right side of the game, and nice from deliver the winner for me.
That's right. Now, what other NFL games of interest, special interest this weekend?
I'm anxious to watch Detroit and Philadelphia because I really firmly believe that Detroit's going to get their first win. I believe Philadelphia could be one of the worst coach teams I've ever seen in recent history. Rookie head coach, rookie offensive coordinator, rookie defensive coordinator. I was at the Raider game last week. I watched them implode. Coming off a bye week, you get a team coming off a bye week, you got to be in tip-top shape, ready to roll. And they look just completely clueless. And so Detroit had the Rams on the ropes. It was 19-17, and they're down two, and they're driving, and they're right down there to take the lead. And Goff throws a pick, and that's all she wrote. And so they're back home. They're getting 3.5, and I just think they're going to pick up their first win for their coach this year. Another game I like that I just keep looking at it, and I just think Atlanta is playing good football under the radar in that division, courtesy of the Saints and courtesy of the Buccaneers. And I think Atlanta and Arthur Smith, who, of course, was the offensive coordinator of Tennessee last year, I think Arthur Smith has them heading in the right direction. So I like Atlanta by the half point, lay 2.5 with the Falcons over Carolina. Last but not least, the big game everybody's talking about, New Orleans and Tampa Bay. And I get that Tom Brady looks great. I get Tampa Bay looks great. I get all that. But when you really break down who they played this year, Dallas gave them all they could handle. They lost to the Rams. They struggled at New England. Their other wins are over Atlanta, who was playing very poorly week two, over Miami, over Philadelphia, over Chicago. This is a division rival at home with a top five defense. As long as Jameis Winston doesn't turn it over, I know he's one crab leg away from going to jail. I get it. But I'm going to take the Saints at home plus the points.
All right, then we shift over to the college ranks, and Brandon, what are the big picks for you this weekend?
Start with Michigan, Michigan State. That's the big one. Two top 10 teams. It's funny, when Michigan State has played Michigan in the past with inferior teams, 11-2 against the spread last 13 meetings, and they actually have a squad this year. We're gonna roll with Michigan State plus the points. Baylor at home, they were good to me over Iowa State. They're laying 2.5 against Texas. Texas is in a complete free fall. Steve Sarkisian, things not going right. I like the Baylor Bears at home, minus the 2.5. And then, of course, last but not least, a team that not many people are paying attention to, but I've watched them all year long. I like this football team. They've had a couple of weeks where they haven't gotten it done, but this week, coming off the game they played last week against Army, Wake Forest minus 16.5 over Duke. Wake Forest put up over almost 70 against Army. And I'm sorry, but they scored 70 against Army, 70-56 against the spread. They've only covered three games this year, but I think they're heading in the right direction. Wake Forest names it on Duke.
There you go. And, of course, Brandon, want to make sure and remind folks to check out a new episode of the podcast today.
Yep, we're going to drop it tonight. Braun is actually going to be making my publicist Braun, who was Matt Leinart's roommate at USC, and USC today with Pete Carroll, Reggie Bush, and I'll give Braun a little razzing about that. He'll be on the podcast tonight. That drops some point tonight, early tomorrow morning. Definitely must listen to podcast TV.
That's right. And of course, the website, BrandonLang.com. Always want to make sure and remind folks of that too, Brandon.
Oh, the one-day free all-access pass. My handicappers are doing a great job. Gus Augustine has been absolutely hot. Al DeMarco on a 6-1 run to start the NBA season. Nice play in the San Antonio Spurs last night, plus 6. Had the Heat the night before in a blowout at Brooklyn. So my guys just doing a great job across the board.
That's good stuff. Well, Brandon, always great to visit with you. Looking forward to the new episode. Tell Braun I said hi.
I will, sir. And hey, congratulations on your 8-2 a couple of weeks ago in the Believe podcast. Pick 'em. You were the champion. 8-2 against the number. Look at you, you little handicapper. You want a free pair of shoes. Well,
I know. How about that? We're in week 8, and I'm tied for first place, though. There you go.
There we go, buddy. Made a handicapper out of you after all.
I know. Well, Brandon, always good to visit with you, brother. Have a great, successful weekend.
Thanks, Nancy, bud.
Do want to say thanks to the sponsor for today's podcast episode, Smiley's Breezy Vapes, located at 313 Falcon Road. Stop in and see them for Wacky Wednesdays, plus they've got great specials and events going on Saturdays. Check out the largest selection of premium juices and disposable flavors in Southwest Oklahoma. That's Smiley's Breezy Vapes, 313 Falcon Road in Altus. For more information, you can call or text at 580-471-VAPE. That's 580-471-8273. If you or your kids end up with a massive stash of candy after this weekend, we have come up with how long you can expect it to stay good for. Number one, chocolate. 8 to 10 months if stored in a cool, dark, and dry place. Dark chocolate can last longer, closer to 2 years. Number 2, hard candy. Stuff like lollipops and butterscotch candies last about a year in their package. As hard candy gets stale, it will become sticky and the texture will feel grainy. Number 3, caramel or caramel, depending how you want to pronounce it. About 6 to 9 months if packaged properly. After that, it will get stale and hard. Number 4, candy corn, about 9 months before it hardens from staleness. Number 5, jellied candies. They last about a year unopened. And number 6, gum? 6 to 9 months.
We've got Tamron Hall, you know her formerly from the Today Show, also has the daytime talk show Tamron Hall. We've got a new book to talk about as well as The Wicked Watch. And first off, Tamron, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, Cameron. It's good to be with you.
Now tell us, with all of the coverage of your own shows, where do you find time to sit down and actually write a novel? Where did that interest come from for you?
You know, it's so funny. Prior to March 2019, when everything went into lockdown, I guess it was March. I don't even know years anymore. All I know is I was taking meetings in person. So back when we were meeting regularly in person, I started to share this idea with my agent, my book agent, about this world of fiction and really wanting to step out of my comfort zone. And I was inspired in part by two cases that I covered, one in Texas and one in Chicago in 1997. And I didn't want to write about those specific stories, but more so I wanted to capture what it felt like as a reporter to cover those stories. They both involved two girls, age 11, and both had been murdered. And this character, Jordan Manning, gave me an opportunity to talk about what it's like for a reporter when you are standing 2 inches away from a crime scene, but then you go home and it's impossible to leave that at work, right? You don't leave work at work. And so when I was pitching this idea with great response, I couldn't believe it. And then the world went in lockdown. And there I was now with insomnia, like everyone else, and trying to, I mean, how many times can you Netflix and chill? I had run through every show imaginable. And I started to pick up my phone and do voice memos about the storyline, where this character would go. And it just started to really flow from my heart. You know, I'm not a skilled novel writer. I've never written a novel in my life. I can write a newscast. I can write a story. I can write a script for a daytime show. But this was a new world for me. It gave me, though, Cameron, an opportunity again to step out of my comfort zone, something that we're all exploring now. We're reprioritizing. We're looking. I'm 51. I was 50 when I was writing this. And I said, you know, it's time. And let's throw caution to the wind and get this novel done.
Now, what were the dry times? When did you face writer's block? What caused that for you? And how'd you get through it? Or did you ever have it?
I did it because I have a 2-year-old toddler. And I said, I've got no time to waste. You know, he's like looking at me and we just transitioned him from formula to whole milk, from puree to solid food, all while this was happening. So between like reading Google toddler snacks, I'm like, I've got no time. So it did give me a sense of urgency having that other side of my life in the house for sure.
Now, has this stirred the writing bug in you? Has it inspired more writings for you, or maybe new ideas in your head?
It has. You know what? It has, to be honest with you. While working on the second in this series, because Jordan Manning is a character very much inspired by my obsession with Nancy Drew as a kid. I had the box set underneath my bed. And, you know, so I see this as an ongoing relationship between the reader and Jordan Manning, but I've just pitched an idea for a children's book inspired by my son that we've already worked out a deal on. So it did ignite something in me, I have to be honest. But on my talk show, we talk about life and what does it mean to have a happy life, a purposeful life, beyond our families, right? What do we do for ourselves? And for me, this was a reminder, this whole process was a reminder of the need to step out of your comfort zone, even if it's taking a dance class, you know, whatever it is, you know, going out to the baseball field again. My mom used to play softball back when I was a kid. She's like, I think I'm going to pick up softball again. I'm like, woman, you're 71. She's like, I'm never back. And so it's like, it's just a reminder of that for me. And I do think to your question, it ignited different aspects of that to step out.
Now, how hard is it to step out of the skin that you're writing in as you're going back into regular life, especially with a little toddler? Was that a challenge to get back to your normal life, if you will?
You know, I mean, I've got my talk show tape in studio, live audience returned this past September. So we have two shows on Tuesday, one show on Wednesday, two shows on Thursday. Three of those are actually live shows. So it has been an interesting juggle, but I recognize it's what my mom was a single mom at 19, right? So she was juggling far more than I am, for sure. And I'm not the only parent doing this, all right? I don't even pretend to like, oh, my parents are any less than this. We're all in some layer of it, juggling our lives. But there are days, to be honest with the camera, and I'm like, I did that. I made dinner. I wrote a book. I did a talk show. And then there are other days I'm in the corner saying, hide from him. He can see you in there, and he knows. You know, can I just have a bath for 5 seconds, people? So, you know, there are these highs and there are lows. But the lows are never too low, and they don't last too long.
Well, Tamron, I feel that I've got to ask you the question. What was the thing, as a talk show host, as a writer, and all of that, what did COVID teach you about yourself?
That I am not a control freak. I thought I was. I thought I liked to and needed to. I'm a Virgo. And I write down everything. We have so many chalkboard. Like, we write down everything in this house. I like order. I don't thrive in chaos. But when you have no control, you finally recognize you never did, right? And I just came to that realization. I still try to have organization in the house. Yes, I sent my husband an Amazon list that he needs to take care of this morning or else. But in reality, when you can't control something, you still thrive. You still figure it out. You don't need the list. I couldn't make a list of paper towels because we couldn't get them, right? So we just figured it out. And I think that's something that I quite enjoy.
That's cool. Now, Tamron, if folks want to find more information about the book, As the Wicked Watch, your other writings upcoming as well, social media and everything else you've got going, where's the best place for folks to keep up?
You can follow me on social media. My name, Tamron, T-A-M-R-O-N, Hall, not with an E like Cameron. I'm on Facebook, Instagram. If you want the book, I encourage you to check out a local bookstore in your area. Let's not forget about them and give them love. But if you don't have one near you and you can't get out, go to Amazon, anywhere else to get the book. And I would love to hear what you think. As I said, I started the second in the series. I've stopped because I need to hear the feedback of the first. I don't want to get too cocky in this thing. So, yeah, just check it out. I'm here. Watch the talk show. And I'm grateful to be in this space, in this moment, in this time. And that means the world to me to be talking to you.
Well, Tamron, it's been a privilege for me this morning as well. I appreciate you taking some time out of what is a crazy busy schedule as well. Thank you for that. Have a great weekend and enjoy some Halloween festivities too.
Oh, I will do that. Thank you.
Merriam-Webster just added 455 new words and phrases to its online dictionary. Some you might know and some you probably don't, and here are a few noteworthy ones. Number 1. Dad bod, a physique regarded as typical of an average father. Number 2. Faux hawk, a hairstyle resembling a mohawk in having a central ridge of upright hair but with the sides gathered or slickened upward or back instead of shaved. Number 3. There's 4 new pandemic-related terms that were added. Breakthrough for cases, super spreader, long COVID, and vaccine passport. Number 4. Doorbell camera, a small camera designed for use on an exterior door that includes or connects to a doorbell. Number 5. Am I right? Slang for the phrase am I right, but spelled A-M-I-R-I-T-E. Number 6. FTW, an abbreviation version of for the win. Number 7, TBH, short for to be honest. Number 8, digital nomad. That's someone who performs their occupation entirely over the internet while traveling, especially if they don't have a permanent address. Number 9, a teraflop. That's a unit of measure for calculating the speed of a computer equal to 1 trillion. The flop part stands for the floating point operation. And number 10, oobleck. It's a type of slime used in science experiments made of cornstarch and water. It's named after the Dr. Seuss book, Bartholomew and the Oobleck.
Got a brand new track that was available last Friday. It is still available as well. We've got singer-songwriter Townsend. We're going to talk about that new track and who knows what else we may talk about. Townsend, great to have the chance to visit with you.
Absolutely. I'm honored to be asked to be on. Thank you for having me.
You say that now. We'll see if it still holds true when we're done, all right?
Correct. If the phone just happens to lose service, don't be surprised.
Yeah, I know, right? Now, one of the things I always like to do, especially on a first visit, is kind of find out where music originated in your life. Who introduced you to music, and when was it that it got a grip on you, if you will?
Sure, absolutely. So I get asked this a lot, and honestly, I feel like music has been part of my life forever, as long as I can remember. So my brother was actually in a Christian rock band, and so he had his drum set up, and I, of course, being the younger sister, was not allowed to touch them, which made me more, you know, curious as to what I was not allowed to touch. And so actually my first instrument that I fell in love with was the drum set. And I played in a punk rock band, and then it just kind of transitioned. I picked up a guitar and started singing with the encouragement of friends. And so, yeah, honestly, as long as I can remember, it's just always been very, very special. And I was the one that would push, new songs would come out, and I just listened to it on repeat, repeat, repeat for months at a time, and just, oh, I love it.
Now, when you first got into doing on the repeat, were you always trying to emulate what you heard?
As far as I can remember, just feeling it. So I've always been really big on lyrics. So even as a child, I remember I loved poetry, and I loved when songs would have a lot of meaning, which who knows what really I thought they stood for at 9 and 10 years old. I'm sure I related it to my life somehow, but I loved when it talked about a story, things that I could relate to, and all the different pieces. Like at that time, I was really into drums. And so sure, I would try to learn all those drum lines and things like that.
That's funny. You mentioned, you talk about songs that you remember from as a kid. The one that always sticks up was Kenny Rogers' Lucille for me when I was little. That was like the first song I ever remember. But I had it wrong because I was so young. He was he had 400 children and a croc in the field. That's what that was the lyrics I knew.
Yes. That would be very confusing to me. I'd be like, I don't understand this Kenny guy. He's very fertile.
That's awesome. Now, you talked about the writing and the lyrics, and I know that you wrote the new single, Stay, and where did this one come from for you?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, I love lyrics. I always love doing my best to kind of wordplay, put them together, make them where people understand and can relate. And so Stay just talks about a stage in a relationship, you know, of what song doesn't come from some kind of love or relationship or breakup. And so, yeah, it just kind of talks about a stage in a relationship that I was in, and talking about how you're waiting for them to change and needs just aren't really being met. And so kind of wordplay on wishing that they would stay and they would meet your needs and kind of go back to how it used to be, but you're just kind of watching it unfold.
Now, where did this come from in your personal life? I mean, all of our personal lives come into our songwriting, into our sharing, whatever artistic venue that is that we use. Where did this one personally come from?
Oh, absolutely. So a relationship that I was in, it was a pretty long relationship. It was pretty serious. And then it got to the point where just needs weren't being met, like I said, and we just kind of watched it unfold, and as much work as we did, we just couldn't get it to stay together. So the song just kind of fell out and was therapeutic for me as this relationship kind of ended. But yeah, so just a relationship that I was in the past, and I felt it would make a good song.
Now, as having new music out in the days that we're living in, I mean, how much different is it putting music out there and getting the feedback over when you first started out, I should say?
So different. I actually love talking about this because I want to make people aware that aren't in the music scene, because if you don't see one-on-one how much work and effort it takes, you don't really appreciate it or don't really understand it. So back in the day, you know, you'd go spend $20-$25 on a CD and the artist would get a ton of that money. And nowadays, anyone and everyone can post something on Spotify, so it's just super saturated. So to be found and for somebody to stream your music, it really takes fans and word of mouth and things like that, like people really helping you out. It really takes a lot of help from the audience to get us what we need to be recognized. And so it has changed a ton. And I think, I don't remember the exact amount, but each stream is like 0.006 cents. You know, it's like a sliver of a penny each time somebody streams a song. So it's super important to support local, to listen, you know, buy merch, tip when they're playing, stream multiple times, share, follow, all of those things social media has brought around.
And how hard is it for you not to keep your eye looking on the numbers? How hard is, I know as a podcaster, I started out and, you know, you get one, two or three and you're like so excited every time you get. Now it's I check daily rather than hourly.
Yes, yes. So thankfully, the streaming services only upload daily. And so I can only send an updated number like every day, but I have to admit I'm guilty of it. I check it every day, of course, just to make sure everything's working properly and to see if the work that I put out is getting any acknowledgement, maybe learn from my mistakes, like, hey, maybe this song didn't get as many streams as this one. And just kind of, like I said, learn from your feedback a little bit.
And what's the feedback been like on Stay so far?
It has been unreal. It's been amazing. This is probably one of the projects I'm most excited about because I got to record with a multi-Grammy winning audio engineer named Zach Allen. He's worked with some really big names like Keb Moe and G-Love and Special Sauce, those people. Some of the best musicians I've ever met, of course, just overwhelmingly amazing. And so to be able to produce this song and release it with all this talent on it has been amazing. Even if nobody listened to it, I would be excited about it anyway. But people are giving such great feedback. I think it's really relatable. It's catchy. The music on it is just, like I said, overwhelmingly talented. Just amazing, amazing. I'm honored that they joined me on this track. So the feedback's been great. I love it.
Now, where would you fit? I know that it's hard whenever you break down into try to get a genre. Is there a genre that you try to stay close to, if you will?
There's not really a genre that I try to hone in on or anything like that. For me personally, I feel like my first album that I released in 2018 was more of a rock phase, and that's kind of just where I was in a healing process and personally. And then this CD came out, or this project came out, and it was more on the country Americana vibe. So it's very like singer-songwriter. Some people mentioned it as pop rock. Some have mentioned it as Americana, some country. So it's kind of in that line, and that's just kind of how it came out. And it's really cool to see how it has changed as I have changed personally and as you grow and mature. So not necessarily anything I hone in on, but I love the country and Americana genre, so I'm not mad to be included in that.
Now, for you to this last couple of years, we've all spent so much time separate away from everybody. What's the music you've been streaming most yourself, and how has your music progressed over the time down as well?
Yeah, so I do a podcast. It's actually about to go live. It's a project right now called You're Not Alone, and I do live streams twice a month. And honestly, that's taken a lot of my time, and it's really helped me grow mentally, emotionally, things like that. And so it kind of all stemmed back to a song that I wrote called Watch the Walls. And it talks about a place, like a dark place that I was going through from a lot of grief and loss. And so I've really been focusing on mental health and kind of sharing the word on it's okay to not be okay and that we all have bad days. And just kind of promoting that mental health should be on the top of our priority list, a lot like emotional health and physical health, and kind of trying to get rid of that bad stigma. So to answer your question, honestly, I've been doing a lot of research as far as that goes. I've been listening to podcasts, kind of like yours. You've got great guests on there. You actually had one talking about anxiety, which is something I talk about on mine as well. And so honestly, I've honed more into that kind of stuff.
It's funny how podcasting can change things, because I've been a radio guy for almost 20 years, and I can see a huge difference that being a part of the podcast community has made in my presentation as well. And how has that helped you? It's obviously going to help you in the talk between songs part, at least right on stage.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's been super cool. It's really, so my goal was to start this project, You're Not Alone, just to make people feel less alone. And like I said, just to kind of beat that bad stigma that we wrap around mental health. Because I think when people think mental health, they think, oh, they're wrapped up in a padded room. And that's not really what it is. And so just kind of being realistic and letting people see, hey, you know somebody that struggles, and you yourself struggle. We all have that day. So honestly, for me, it's been amazing as far as building a community. And so I've gotten super close with all the guests that I have had on there. I've started a private group on Facebook called You're Not Alone. And so it's all the people that I've had, all the people that have watched, and they can get on there and chit-chat with each other just as a support group, as a team, to get on there and be like, man, I've had a bad day. Does anybody have advice? Or hop on there and be like, hey, listen, I listened to this great podcast. Y'all should check it out if you're having a hard time. So for me, the benefit has been, one, I love learning. I'm all about learning new things. Two, just building a community, getting closer to my fans and making more friends. And it's been really cool to watch happen.
Now, how hard is it to be so open? I mean, how scary was it when you first entertained the idea, if you will?
Terrifying. Terrifying. It took me, honestly, this pandemic where we weren't allowed to play or be around people is kind of when I learned, okay, you know what? People respond better when you're vulnerable and you're your genuine self. And so I have found that being open, being genuine, and just providing a shoulder and an ear for people has been far more beneficial than anything else I could have ever gone through, right? And so it's been really cool just to connect with people on a different level. But yeah, it's terrifying. It's just like releasing a new song. That's like letting the world read your diary. Like, it's so scary because they're not only judging your music, but they're judging the lyrics, which you wrote about something personal. So it's always terrifying, but it's worth it. You just kind of got to take the leap of faith.
So along those lines, does it make it, whenever you do have a release, does it, the response, do you take that more personal when it's a personally written song yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I'm only human. So any feedback you get back, you're going to take personal. I know they tell you, don't take the negative feedback, which thankfully I haven't had any. I've got an amazing, amazing support group, amazing friends and fans that speak highly. But absolutely, hearing good feedback and hearing one-on-one advice and that they relate really just, it feels good. It always feels good to hear a good word.
That's right. Now, Townsend, what does the schedule look like for the rest of 2021 and moving into 2022? Things starting to pick up on the tour dates as well?
Absolutely. So since COVID, probably about, I would say February or March, things kind of picked up as far as playing locally, playing in bars and private parties. So I am booked solid. I'm already booking out until next year, until about March or April. And things are looking great, been super busy. So I am thankful and trying to stay open-minded that things are going to stay good and we're going to be on the right track. So I'm trying to stay optimistic and positive about it all, but it's just play it day by day. But yeah, things are picking up. I'm swamped, and it's such a blessing.
That's a good problem to have. That's a good problem
yes,
to have.
It is. I try to remind myself every day when I'm running from gig to gig or podcast to gig that this is a blessing. Like, soak it in.
That's right. Now, again, the single is available now. And Townsend, I want to make sure and let our listeners know, where's the best place to keep up with tour dates, merch, giving tips to the artist? Where's the best place to do any of that stuff?
Absolutely. So I'm super active on all social media accounts. So anytime you want to look me up on Instagram or Facebook, it's at Townsend T Music. I keep my dates on there. I keep posts on there. And then if you want a little laugh, I do TikTok, just trying to get people in a good mood. And that's Townsend T Music as well. But if you want to look at merch, you want to buy those things, I have a website, and it's www.townsendtmusic.com. And then, of course, it'll be posted on there, but my new podcast is called You're Not Alone with Townsend, and 4 times a month, so every Monday I get on there and chat with somebody of a completely different topic, from OCD to bipolar to musicians during a pandemic. We talk about everything, but be sure to check that out, because if you can't relate, I bet you know somebody that could.
Well, Townsend, it has been great getting to visit with you today. I'm glad that I now have another new friend over in Arkansas.
Absolutely. Yeah, give me a call anytime. I have enjoyed it. It was an honor to hop on here with you.
Well, thanks again for joining us for this 143rd episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, a question, maybe anything else you'd like to know, you can hit me up on the contact page at gqwithcam.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook at GQWithCam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, you can visit our merch store where we've got hoodies, shirts, mugs, tumblers, stickers, and more, gqwithcam.com/shop. And if you have a special guest idea, you can email me, gqwithcam@gmail.com. Thanks again to our good friend Brandon Allen for coming up with our theme music. We're going to let him play us out and hope you guys have a great rest of your weekend.